Trump was there to hear all that, glowering at Judge Merchant. It's going to be a long, 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 long March, April, and May, guys. And I haven't even mentioned June, July, and August. And God help us, September, October, November. Just saying. Oh, dear. You know, I have not talked at all about the Georgia case and this possibility of Fannie Willis being pulled because of her amorous relationship with one of the prosecutors. I don't know. That to me was in many ways always the most important case, just by virtue of the bold efforts by Trump and his cohorts after January 6th had, before January 6th had failed to change the vote after the election. The phone call alone, just find me, you know, exactly the number of votes they needed. Just, it's just so clearly criminal conduct. And that this case could be in any way jeopardized because of sex. I got to tell you, one of the advantages of being an old woman, and I'm sure this isn't true for all old women, but for a lot, is losing that libido. And all that energy that took now can be directed to things that just seem so much more meaningful. There's something wonderful about the human body for a woman when she is past childbearing age, that it lets her off the hook from all of that. You guys, not so much. That drive stays with you, I guess, till the end of your days. And I feel for you. I really do. Because there is so many other places to put that energy with satisfaction, right? But if you still have the drive, you're doomed. I don't know where that came from, but I've really, it's one of the gifts of old age, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Barbara sent me this. Under the ethos of MAGA, a man can rape a woman and brag about grabbing her genitalia without permission and still occupy the most powerful office in the nation. But a woman in a consensual affair with outside counsel is disqualification from service, potentially. It's just, yeah, always a double standard, always a double standard, especially when sexuality is involved. It's why this case that will first go to trial is considered, you know, sort of small potatoes. Because after all, what was it about? It was just understandably about a married man trying to do whatever he needed to do to, you know, make sure that his wife and others didn't hear about his infidelity. No big deal, right? But the reality is, it appears that he committed a number of felonies in the process of doing it. And even if they're not the major ones, this time he didn't kill anybody, defame anybody, just sent checks to the guy who paid the hush money, Michael Cohen. All right, I have to tell you that, you know, getting away from this Trump stuff for a minute here. So we've got those two. I've already referenced two cases that are front and center in the news today. Tomorrow, a big expectation of a third case. This is who Republicans genuflect to. This crook. God, it's mind-boggling. So tomorrow, in another New York City courtroom, it is believed that Judge Engoron will finally unveil his decision. And his decision amounts to a dollar figure in large part. How much money Donald Trump is going to have to surrender, scrape up, and pay for the fraud that he committed over the years as a incredibly brilliant, successful New York businessman. Also, the possibility that he will be denied the ability to ever again do business in New York City. And there are, in this case, a lot of safeguards where Trump will not be able to game the system. The money is going to have to be found. People will have to be paid. It will, even if he wants to appeal, as is his habit, will have to be produced and put in escrow. So it's all, I mean, when the law finally catches up, all the escape routes, and he makes use of every single one of them, as we're now all learning and watching and seeing, but eventually the clock runs out. And the clock is running out on a lot of these cases. So that's the good news. I got to about Kansas City. I guess not so much about Kansas City. I got to talk about this country, us, and media. I turned on CNN when I heard that there'd been a shooting after the parade. And was greeted with when I worked in television, there's a certain story type called an evergreen. We label them evergreens. It's a story that is, you know, works at any time. You can always, you know, you can write evergreen stories with 3/4 of your brain out of commission. It's just, you know, and think of what those evergreen stories are. In this country now, they're shootings. They're just so constant that we fall in media, you fall into a routine in the coverage of them. You follow the exact same steps. You ask the exact same questions. The fact that we, the audience watching this. Now know all the questions. We know the answers. We know the routine. And what was interesting about this, as far as we know at this point, only one person killed. One person killed doesn't even get into a newspaper these days. This did not rise to the level that usually interests media, but for the fact that it was related to the biggest eyeball catcher in media that there is, the NFL, the Super Bowl. And so this time, there's a slightly different narrative. Always the few little differences allow for media to pick up and run, using a football metaphor. And there's almost an excitement, it seems to me, in this. Oh, here we go again, but this time it's different. We got football. We've got this huge crowd. We have a celebration gone awry. But celebrations gone awry, that's nothing new. That's become tedious. So often these mass shootings with a far greater toll don't get as much as that one got yesterday. This one was different. There were two governors there who had to run for their lives. Two governors of states that allow anybody to have a gun and to carry the gun and to show they got a gun. Governors of states that have promoted the fetishization of gun ownership in this country, which has led to more than one mass killing a day, every day in the United States. I saw a quote from a woman, I think Somalian. She was not from the United States, but she was talking to a friend about the anxiety that she had noted in American children. And I forget the context of why she would have been with American children and this and that. And she said, I realized that, of course, these American children have anxiety. They're being raised in a war zone. They're being raised in a country that apparently has come to terms, no problem whatsoever, about having their children go to school and once a month be reminded that they are sitting ducks and can be blown away by an active shooter who enters their building. And they are given all the tools they need to survive this. I saw one interview, I think it was on CNN, of a woman who was there with her daughter. You know, she's being interviewed about the horror of the moment and running with her daughter and realizing that her daughter was wiser about what to do in this situation than she. My daughter, she says, has active shooting drills every month. And she said this as if it were a positive. You know, like, whoa, when I went to school, we never learned that. See how much progress has been made? So I'm listening to the coverage, and I'm getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Wolf effing Blitzer. Almost every time somebody would say something, he says in that sort, I can't stand him, God. He would say, yeah, yeah, good question. No, it isn't. It isn't a good question. It's a question that we have heard 700 gazillion times. It might have been a good question the first time, but the question now is, what the hell is the answer? Just Wolf Blitzer in automaton mode. And here before, here's what we do. And so there was a professional football player who the producers found, probably Kansas City, I don't know, and he's being interviewed. And he says, one of many who, of course, said it, you never expect anything like that to happen. Now, you don't? Now, see, that's like now a laugh line. Right? And yet, obligatorily, the police chief says this is not Kansas City, and I'm screaming at the television. Yes, it is. It's Kansas City. It's every city in this country. It's America. It is. And this is one of the reasons we won't deal with this. We refuse to acknowledge it is who we are. People who stand by and allow their children to grow up in a war zone and be terrorized once a month in school so they'll be ready. I'm seeing articles about how when you go to an event with lots of people, how always look for the escape routes, or, for that matter, don't even go. The mayor of KC saying, you know, I was thinking of bringing my son, and now you can tell he ain't bringing his son ever to anything like this. So we allow this insanity to spread, the fear that it creates, the self-confinement that it creates. Blitzer actually at one point when I'm telling you, I listened for all of 15 minutes. Blitzer at one point said, this was his question to somebody. Do you think should we stop going out and celebrating together? That's the moral of the day's events. That's what you get from what happened yet again ad nauseum. We should live in fear and cease to socialize together. We should surrender. We should not take action and solve this insanity. No, that didn't come up. In the time I listened, there was not one person who said anything like, we all have blood on our hands, and I am sick and tired of it. Who are we as a people when we clearly seem to have reached a point where we are willing, obviously, to bear thousands of people being gunned down for no reason whatsoever. Because there's a greater good. And that greater good is that some other people can buy all the guns they want, can carry them anywhere they want, can sell them, fetishize them, and trade them and exhibit them and gift them and shoot them. And they can be truly lethal weaponry, normally used by military. But in this great country, sure. And there are trade-offs, you know, to freedoms. There are always trade-offs. And the trade-off here is, well, children at Marjorie Taylor Greene, the children at the children here and the children there, the grocery shoppers here, the movie goers there, the revelers in KC and Las Vegas and the people dancing in LA and the folks in Pittsburgh who were just praying. Yeah, this is the price that we in this country have decided we are willing to pay. It's extraordinary. It's unbelievable. And here again, this is mostly brought to you by Republicans and the people who vote for them. I do not let Democrats off the hook on this one, because there's plenty, especially around here, plenty of gun-loving Democrats in Western PA. And I just have to say that until people start voting and get these folks out, unless we have Democrats in the executive who will appoint justices who know how to read an amendment, even foundationally, there is no way the writers of that Constitution envisioned that this is what the Second Amendment meant. Don't have to go to law school or be a historian to know that. Quite a deal with the devil we have made. Quite a calculation on the side of death, of innocence. It's really astonishing. So when we look to what we've become, you know, look no farther than yesterday, what happened, how it was covered, robotic sameness of it all. You know, one of the things that I've been wondering, given the fact that I know Kansas is, I think, and Missouri are both free carry states. You can, you know, again, you could have gone to that rally with an AK. Every kind of, you know, you could have gone to that rally. People could have openly carrying all that stuff. I heard, I didn't hear what the crowd count was, but I heard that more than two times the population of Kansas City could well be in the streets for that parade. The city was essentially shut down. So there could have been as many as a million people there. And I'm wondering, given where it was, the state it was in, the mindset of so many Americans. How many people there do you think were carrying guns? What percentage? Maybe this question has been asked on some. I'm serious. This is where my head went. Wait a minute. How many guns were there? And then I thought of what the NRA has always told me, that all it takes to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, hell, my bet is there were more good guys with guns there. I'm serious. More good guys with guns there than bad guys with guns. But what if, let's say, I don't think they know yet, do they? That one bad guy shot a gun for whatever reason. In a situation where a ton of good guys with guns could be heroes and respond. Is it conceivable that that's when they unravel this thing is what happened? Boy, they don't want it to be that. Oh, dear, dear, dear heaven, they don't want it to be that. But I would not, given the reality, be surprised that what we might find is some of those children in the hospital, the mother of two who's dead. Who knows? Could have been killed by a good guy with a gun. I have a caller. Hello.
What did I hear somebody say once? A wash, rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we're doing right now?
That's it.
I mean, you have a shooting, thoughts and prayers. It's too soon to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And then we have another shooting because we never do anything about it. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and here's the latest thing, of course, is look, because everybody now has 20,000 guns, it's too late. How are you ever going to confiscate them? You can't confiscate them. They'd shoot anybody trying to confiscate them. They aren't going to surrender them. So we give up. We say there's nothing we can do. And it just keeps escalating and escalating. This is insanity. The definition of insanity.
Yep.
Incredible.
Well, what if the Democrats and Biden take the lead and say, you know what, we're done. You know, so we have another time. And every time it happens, then they just say, okay, Republicans, we're not going to come up with any solutions because you just reject everything we suggest. You come up with a solution. It's all on you now. And just step away. Because this is our new reality. Like you said, it's not going away. But at some point, you've got to somehow get that finger pointing so it's obvious and say, we've done everything we can do and we're not getting any help. You come up with a solution. Or is this going to just be our new – it is our new normal, but is this acceptable to you?
Well, you know, of course, but no, they will not act, and we know that. And then I think we're well beyond that. I think the American people desperately want some action taken. I think most Americans are not crazy. And this is how the abortion issue works for Democrats. Most Americans are not with the Republicans on abortion. And I also think most Americans are not on the gun issue. And I was glad to see that the president yesterday, this is the only, I saw this in writing. he came out and said, I want Americans to stand with me. He said, Congress needs to ban assault weapons. We need to limit high capacity magazines. We need to strengthen background checks. And then he said, what are we waiting for? What else do we need to see? How many more families need to be torn apart? That's what our president said. And I think that's a winning message. I do.
I think what you said before about the majority of Americans who are for things and against things, but the minority keeps control. I mean, that's what's happened in this country.
Yeah, that is what's happening.
It's all about the powerful minority. And I don't think you and I are going to see anything budge on any of those issues or similar issues in our lifetime.
Well, listen, vote the Republicans out and you will see things happen. Get a Democratic Congress, get a Democrat in the White House, and they can appoint Democrats or people who are not corrupted to the Supreme Court. Get back to honorable people who believe in government and protecting Americans, and we can start doing something about this, as opposed to Republicans who only want to protect the rich, the powerful, and the corporations.
I just say that we've got too many pockets of areas in this country where the Republicans will never lose. And that's the problem. And I don't know how we fix that. And I'm not saying I'm just going to just shrug my shoulders and walk away. I'm going to still talk the talk and vote and try to be a voice of reason. But I think I'm hoping this mentality dies off, because there is a difference I see in how young people think versus us. Not always good, but I just hope it's not too late, you know? And I don't think that we're, like, I would be pleasantly surprised if in my lifetime I see a significant shift in the gun issue or any type of these issues where the rich are always protected and powerful and doing whatever the hell they want. But maybe 30 or 50 years from now, it might happen.
That's where we start with thoughts and prayers. Let's hope let's pray, you're right. But it's action that is required and resolve. And we are a nation on so many precipices. It's mind blowing. It really is. Hey, thank you. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
Nice to hear from
all
you.
Right.
Okay.
Sure.
Bye bye. Bye. Milton has sent me an email and I'm going to share it. I haven't read the whole thing, but I see from the first sentences what it's about, and I'm glad. Milton is writing as a person of color. And I'll just do it. And Milton, I promise you, I'm just going to read it and I'm not going to interrupt it. Okay, I'll say it. I'll say it because apparently the racial politics of the day has barred any non-person of color from saying it, but it needs to be said. Bonnie Willis fucked up. Big time. Not just as a prosecutor, not just as a woman in a coveted position as a DA in a major American city, but as a black woman. From the time we are old enough to comprehend that there are differences between the ruling class, white, and our place here in America, Black folks are taught, told, demanded, excoriated, and implored that we will always have to be twice as good to achieve half as much. Before we begin grammar school, this edict becomes part of both our conscious and subconscious reality, like washing your hands before coming to the dinner table or looking both ways before crossing the street. We know that our behavior will be scrutinized, dissected, and noted on what seems like a microscopic level. For Fonnie Willis to have achieved all that she has, to have had the biggest class in American political history, in American political history handed to her, with the evidence of guilt served to her on a silver platter, and then to risk this most important case in her position for an inter-office affair, unforgivable. And every Black person in America is disappointed. We won't say it in mixed company. Hell, some of us won't even say it to one another. But we all feel it. We feel betrayed by her because she betrayed the first rule of being an accomplished Black person in America. You must always be twice as good to achieve half as much. Bonnie Willis fucked up. Thank you for that, Milton. I have thought that. I have felt anger toward her for this, because yes, she allowed an opening. She knew better. It's why I haven't talked about it. I have not brought this up since it happened, because it just so upset me. So thank you. Really, thank you. That was eloquent. Sad as hell, but eloquent. And again, a reminder of reality. Okay, a few things to sort of get us finished off here. I want to note the passing. I think it was last week I noted the passing of a Pittsburgh survivor of the Holocaust. She was 106, I believe, and had lived this extraordinary life. And I need to tell you that Pittsburgh has lost another. They're so old now. Even these people who've endured so much and then managed to live these full, wondrous lives. But we've lost another, and a great one. His name was Moshe Baron. He died at the age of 103 last year. Last week. He had a very different story than so many of the survivors. He was never in a concentration camp. He was a fighter. He was a partisan. His story is actually one that doesn't get heard enough. He was born in a little town in Poland. And he used to say that his grandmother slept in a little pallet above the oven in the middle of the house because it was the warmest place to be. This was a dirt-floored house. And the Soviets came in to the village first in 1939. And Jews started disappearing even then, sent to Siberia. And then in 41, the Nazis came. And with them, horror untold. Prominent Jews, including Moshe Baron's uncle, were publicly executed. He and his brother were sent to different towns as forced laborers. And in 42, the Jews that were left in that town were forced at gunpoint into a barn that was then set on fire. He escaped, and with his immediate family, they escaped because they went into hiding in a nearby town. His grandmother did not. And the ones that survived ended up in another Polish town, in another ghetto, and he then escaped again with some other young men. They stole some weapons from the Germans. And that's when they joined, went into the forest and joined partisans. With them, he retrieved his family, what was left, and other weapons. He got his sister, his brother, and their mother out, hiding in a wagon driven by a Christian farmer who was working with the partisans. Another sister who was ill had remained with their father, and 2 days later, they were both shot down by the Germans, along with 2,000 other members of that ghetto. So this survivor spent the horrors of that time ambushing Nazi garrisons, blowing up railroad tracks, lighting signal fires in the forest so Soviet planes could see where to drop supplies. And then, when Germany's finally defeated, this guy, Moshe Baron, is drafted into the Soviet army and spent 3 years in that before arriving at a displaced person camp in Austria. And there he met a Polish orphaned survivor, Malka. She moved to Israel. He went to Shreveport, Louisiana, when somebody there agreed to sponsor him. But he kept corresponding with the Polish orphaned Malka in Israel. And eventually he went there. He got her. He married her. And he brought her back to the United States. And they lived here for a long time. When they were older, they went to live. They raised their family in New York, but they came here when one of their sons came here. And another son went to Israel to live. And I have heard of him many times. He's a wonderful human being. Wonderful. He told his story in classrooms, in documentaries, Never lost his laughter, his wit, his smile. It's amazing. So, another God, Moshe Baron. I wanted to tell you about him. Oh, man. Speaking of death, I wished I'd seen this on Valentine's Day, because this is a Valentine's Day story, but I'll back up and tell it to you. It's told by a historian who I follow, Heather Cox Richardson. And she talks about a Valentine's Day in 1884. And Theodore Roosevelt. Four years earlier, on Valentine's Day, in 1880, Theodore Roosevelt married the woman he had been courting for more than a year, Alice Hathaway Lee. And he wrote this in his diary. I can scarcely realize that I can hold her in my arms and kiss her and caress her and love her as much as I choose. They married. Some god-awful reason. They moved into the house of his mom. They moved in with mother. Martha Roosevelt in New York City. And they lived high on the, they went to fancy parties, traveled to Europe, yada, yada, yada. He then gets elected to the state assembly. So they moved to Albany. And he was considered, some Harvard-educated rich guy who was derided by some of the more rough-and-tumble pals there. In 83, his wife realized that she was pregnant, and in the fall, she moved back to New York City to be with her mother-in-law, awaiting the birth of their child. And Roosevelt was absolutely certain that this kid was going to come on Valentine's Day. Well, he was wrong, because his daughter arrived on the 12th, 2 days before Valentine's Day. And the child was named after the mom. She was named Alice. Roosevelt came back to New York in time to see his wife become very ill. She never recovered from the birth. She died 2 days later. On Valentine's Day. And unbelievably, in the same house, his mother died that day as well. I've looked at a screenshot of his diary page for February 14, 1884, he put this big black X in the diary and wrote in this elegant handwriting of the day, "The light has gone out of my life. Wow. He was so desperate to escape. I mean, I don't know who took the baby. The grandmother's dead. The mother's dead. And like so many men, I don't think he took the baby Alice. He escaped to the Dakota Territory, to a ranch that he had invested in. And it's there that he rode horses, he roped cattle, and he toyed with the idea of spending the rest of his life out there as a rancher. But there was a brutal winter, killed off 80% of his cattle herd. And he went back east and went back to politics. But now he wasn't thought of as a Harvard, you know, Harvard upper crust creep. He was thought of as a cowboy, which of course dominated the romantic ideal of American malehood. So he ran for political office again as a Western cowboy, taking on the corruption in the East. And he succeeded. He ended up as the vice president. And then in 1901, an unemployed steel worker assassinated President William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt. That damned cowboy, as one of McKinley's advisors called him, became the president of the United States. Quite a story, huh? And of course, Alice, I got to look more into her life. That baby born 2 days before her mother's death. That baby became a real wondrous, tough character. Alice Roosevelt. Isn't she the one who said things like, if you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, come here. Sit next to me. Was she that one? I think so. She was a pistol. Oh, there's that. Okay. And I leave you with one other thing, which is just beyond belief, and I've been sitting on it, and I'm going to share it with you now. When you go get your hair cut and stuff, all that hair ends up on the floor. What happens to all of the hair that gets clipped? Believe it or not, the United States and Canada throw out 32 tons of hair per day. 32 tons of hair per day. So people are always looking for things that they could do with them. I mean, you know, the wig industry has often used the, you know, but I'm talking about the shorter stuff. And there are nonprofits and companies that are taking human hair and having it made into fertilizers. It's being used to clean up oil spills, actually breaking it down into its essential amino acids. It's put into other beauty products. So there's always this desire, yes, of course, I mean, it's ecologically smart, to reuse all that tonnage of human hair. And the thing is, human hair is so common, we don't give it its due. Listen to this. It has a strength to weight ratio, okay? Strength to weight, it obviously doesn't weigh much, but its strength to weight ratio is similar to that of steel. One head of hair could suspend two elephants in the air. Ain't gonna look at your hair the same way again. It holds heat, it sheds water, it traps oil. It springs back into shape when bent and can stretch up to 70% of its length without breaking. This is an amazing thing, a human hair. The Greeks and the Romans, their soldiers braided human hair into elastic ropes for catapults. So a lot of people have been studying the strength of human hair, the structure of human hair, and trying to see if there are ways it could be used in the same way, you know, like steel rebar reinforces concrete walls. Could it be used to strengthen building materials? And all that is, believe me, constantly being watched. But here's where this is heading, because this is a story that is headlined. This unexpected material might be in your next sweater. And there are people working to take human hair and make it into essentially fabric. Yarn. It can be dyed any color. I'm looking at pictures of like upholstery that's done with human hair. And it's beautiful. The problem is there's this yuck factor, right? So the woman who's making all of this material says, if I just show somebody a sample, they say, oh, man, that is so beautiful. That's gorgeous. And then I tell them it's made of human hair, and they go, ugh. Human hair comes free. Unlike sheep, you know, we feed ourselves, wash our own hair, pay to cut it off. So all that is required is someone to collect it. So anyway, gotta tell you, this is a fantastic story about human hair being used. And how, what an incredible, how warm it is. And you wouldn't know. What I'm saying is you wouldn't know it's human hair. And I was thinking, well, ignorance is bliss, so don't tell anybody. But then, of course, you have to, because you have to, you know, every time you buy a garment, there's a tag that tells you what it is made of. Anyway, this one woman who is behind all of this, her goal is to produce about 500,000 tons of human hair fabric annually in 10 years' time. Imagine a sweater, she says, that you can buy that will last 9,000 years. Because stop and think about it. Mummies, have you seen a mummy? Their hair is still there. Okay, there was that. I had to share that. Is that not amazing? You've heard of the term, he's wearing his hair shirt, right? That has a negative connotation. But, wow. Okay, guys, thank you so very much. Between now and when I come back on Monday, you know, God in heaven help us what has been learned and what we've survived, and we'll talk about it. That's all I can say. Have a good weekend.
Lynn Cullen Live, Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.